Welcome to New Books in Russian and Eurasian Studies. I'm your host, Joy Neumeier. Today we'll be talking to Rebecca Mitchell about her book, Nietzsche's Orphans, Music, Metaphysics, and the Twilight of the Russian Empire, published by Yale University Press. Nietzsche's Orphans traces how in late imperial Russia, music came to be seen as a transcendent force that could overcome the problems of modernity, as well as what happened to this dream after 1917. It also provides some really fascinating insight into some of Russia's major composers and the contexts that shaped their work. Rebecca Mitchell, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So just to get us started, I was hoping you could tell us a bit about yourself, how you came to studying Russia and music.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm originally from a very small town in northeastern Saskatchewan in Canada. I was born in a town called Nipawin, probably about 5,000 people total. And so it was a long way from there to end up studying and doing a PhD in Russian history. And it was not a very straightforward path that I followed, actually. I became interested in music early on, and I took piano lessons from the time I was about 8. And I played a lot of different kinds of music. I played a lot of music by Chopin and others. And then my first degree was actually in music. I did a Bachelor of Music degree in piano performance. And it was while I was at university that I discovered the music of the composer Alexander Scriabin. I was looking for, some new repertoire to try out. And I was just fascinated. I had never heard music like that before. So that was sort of my first in into thinking about Russia more broadly. I remember at the time I went to the library after I had discovered Scriabin because I wanted to learn more about his background. And at that point in time, I didn't find any particularly insightful literature about him. I found some things that piqued my curiosity, such as the fact in one biography I read that he thought that he was God. But it didn't actually explain that much. And I kept looking, and I discovered that he had written philosophical notebooks, but they hadn't been translated into English. And that was then sort of the next impetus for me to think about learning Russian language. And, things progressed from there. I became more and more aware that, especially when you look at someone like Scriabin, you can't understand his music without understanding the culture that he came from. And so that ultimately developed into me going to Russia, doing some language study there, and falling in love with the history of the country as well. And so in the end, I did a PhD in Russian history at the University of Illinois, and I was able to bring together those two interests.
Mm-hmm. So what was the place of music in turn of the century Russia that you explore in your book? And what was it about music in particular, rather than other art forms, that made it so central to the culture?
Well, one of the things that I became very interested in as I started reading more about late imperial Russia, so the time right before the 1917 revolution, was how ubiquitous discussions of music actually were. This was not just within like musical circles per se, but within educated society more broadly. A lot of literary figures from the time, a lot of artists as well, were obsessed with this image of music and its potential power in a way to transform the world around them. And they had somewhat different perspectives on what exactly that meant. But they all really appreciated the fact that, at least from their perception, music was unique amongst all of the arts because it existed in time, but it didn't really have a spatial component in the same way as the other art forms. And this, of course, ties in with ideas that go back to Hegel and to Schopenhauer as well. But this idea that music was somehow more spiritual than the other arts, that it was a higher form of art because it had this more immediate connection to the human spirit, I think was one of the things that attracted so many people to thinking about music as a way of overcoming the material conditions that they found themselves in.
And would you say there's anything unique about the role of music in turn of the century Russia as opposed to, say, in Germany or elsewhere in Europe?
Well, to a certain extent, I think it's a continuation of the romantic impulse in music that we see in Germany and France and other countries, particularly in Germany, of course. One of the things that I found really fascinating in the case of Russia is that the 19th and the early 20th centuries are really times where you have an impulse towards the nationalization of musical styles. And you see that very strongly in Germany, this idea that music is somehow embodying the soul of the people, right? With Herder and folk song and this sort of thing. In the Russian context, it became really interesting because, Russia, of course, is an empire with people of many different ethnic backgrounds. And there seemed to be a really interesting tension between this image of music as somehow embodying a specific national character, and then the fact that not everyone who was participating in musical spheres in Russia would consider themselves ethnically Russian. And so it had this interesting component of touching upon, I think, a central issue in educated society of the time, which was, what does it actually mean in this context to be Russian? And that there were different understandings of that, which also gives it a really unique status in terms of thinking about Russia as empire as well.
Mm-hmm. So who were Nietzsche's orphans in particular, and why do you refer to them as orphans rather than sons or daughters?
So the term that I used for them actually came to me rather spontaneously. I was riding the Moscow metro when I was doing my dissertation research, and I was thinking a lot about the texts that I'd been reading, the letters and the various publications that came out of educated society in Russia. And I should note that the people I talk about in my book are from the educated levels of society. These are people that, for the most part, traveled to Europe. They had connections. I don't look at the lower echelons of society and music in that context. So there were people who were participating in a broader European discourse about music, about culture, about philosophy. And it struck me that, in particular, Nietzsche's conception of music as this Dionysian force underlying reality, this sort of unifying impulse, was something that a lot of them were drawing on very strongly. And that was clear in many of the sources. Sometimes they would refer specifically to Nietzsche. More often they would talk about, the Dionysian power of music, that sort of thing. But the reference was clear. And so I knew that I needed to talk about Nietzsche in some way. Problematic thing I kept finding, though, was that they didn't really fit, at least my conception of what Nietzsche had been saying in his philosophy. And the more I looked at their ideas about music and about society and nation and the transformation of society in the modern world, the clearer it became that they were very selectively reading Nietzsche. And I think the most striking example of this is simply the fact that, they talk about Nietzsche in very elevated language. Sometimes they actually refer to him as a prophet, as the figure who most perfectly understood the future path that humanity was to follow. So, incredibly dramatic words. But they always come back to this argument that he made one small mistake in his interpretation. And that mistake was that he didn't believe in God. And, if you know Nietzsche's philosophy, it's really strange to try and imagine, on the one hand, embracing Nietzsche as a prophet, and then at the same time saying, you know, he was mistaken about that one little thing. And so I was trying to come up with a way of capturing that irony, that on the one hand, they are so much drawing on Nietzsche's ideas and influence, and at the same time, they are so actively distancing themselves. Because one of the arguments that comes out time and again is that the problem with modernity is that humans have lost touch with the spiritual aspect and with religion. And for some of them, this means, of course, more traditional conceptions of religion, orthodoxy. For others, you know, not so much the traditional idea that we have, but very much the sense that we need not just to transform human society, but we need to, in a sense, re-spiritualize it. And so I came up with the idea of orphans because in this way, I thought it captured this distance that they had. And then the other problem that I noticed a lot as I was thinking about this more and looking at what a lot of the writers and composers and figures that I look at wrote about Nietzsche, they're also very aware of the fact that they are drawing on a German writer in order to try and help them define what it means to be Russian. And of course, there's a very strong irony in that as well, because part of this process of celebrating music and its spiritual transformative power is also about imagining what Russia should be. And so there's almost a bad conscience that some of them seem to have that in order to get this inspiration, they have to draw from someone who actually is not himself Russian. And so in that sense too, it felt like the image of the orphan really captured these distances that my historical subjects had from Nietzsche.
Mm-hmm. So before we talk a bit more about the reading of Nietzsche and conception of music more broadly, I'm hoping you could talk a bit more about the social context for this world of educated listeners that you describe. Where did they meet? How did they connect? Were there any women? Was it all men? How did it all work?
So when I started the project, it was initially focused particularly on looking at composers, three composers, and the composers themselves changed as I did more research. But it was very, I would say, male dominated. All of the composers I found that were active at the time and being written about extensively in the press were men. Almost all of the critics writing the things that were being published were men as well. And I initially had this feeling like, you know, are there no women involved in musical life? And then I started thinking a bit more about the social component. Where were people meeting to talk about these ideas? And where were they going to actually listen to the music? And that's when I suddenly realized that there was a really important place that women held in this society. And of course, it's not necessarily that they are the visible ones making the music, but they are very active in terms of creating the spaces where music is held and where music is talked about. So for instance, one of the figures in my book, Margarita Morozova, was a wealthy widow. Her husband had died at a young age, and she was very devoted both to philosophy and to music in particular. She took piano lessons from two of the composers I looked at, Alexander Scriabin and Nikolai Metner, and she also hosted salon events in her house where she would basically invite the cultural elite in Moscow at the time to come and, you know, discuss these big ideas. And amongst those ideas, she was really interested in music, and she was also interested in spirituality and the revival of sort of pure Russianness. And there were also many women that were present at these events that were not necessarily reflected in the initial written sources that I was looking at. And so If I was to characterize the individuals that I look at, I mentioned already that they are from the cultural elite. They tend to be from urban centers. A number of them come from provincial cities, but perhaps moved to Moscow or Petersburg at some point in time. So a lot of them have spent time abroad in Europe and have a very strong sense of themselves as cultured Europeans as well as Russians. And there's that interesting dichotomy, particularly because at the same time that they see themselves as Russian and not European necessarily, they're also very aware of their status within Russian society and that they are a very small group within the larger framework of Russia. So they are seldom interacting with peasants or workers, but they have very clear ideas about, you know, what the ideal Russians culture that came out of the, in part came out of peasant society, looked like. So they're very productive. If you study culture from the time period, these would be the individuals that you come across quite often. So I looked at writers like Andrei Bielý, Vyacheslav Ivanov, as well as musicians, and some artists as well. Some of them are involved in politics, but politics didn't tend to come up at these events specifically. Usually this tends to be a group of people that think that culture and transformation of cultural life is the way to move forward. Mm-hmm. So yeah, they would be this small group. Very privileged in the context of the time, but also extremely influential in the artistic production that they were engaged in.
Mm-hmm. So to turn now to the ideas that they were discussing and disseminating, the first chapter of your book is called Musical Metaphysics in Late Imperial Russia. What was musical metaphysics?
So I actually drew this term from some of the articles that were being written at the time to talk about music. And I liked it because of its reference to metaphysics, but also its vagueness, actually, because I found that in a lot of these discussions about music, there are constants. It's always seen as this transformative power. It's a spiritual force rather than a material force. But they don't actually tend to define it explicitly in relation to musical styles. And it's much more about the impact that music has on the human listener. And so I liked the idea of this being a metaphysical impulse. And the idea that it is musical also references this widespread idea that music is something that appeals immediately and directly to the emotions rather than to the rational mind. So it's seen then as a way of transcending the everyday rational world that we live in and achieving a higher level of reality, which it's believed is possible actually through the experience of a musical work. But what that specifically looked like in terms of musical style is never clearly defined or agreed upon. So I really liked this dualistic aspect of the term.
Mm-hmm. You already hinted at this a few minutes ago, but what problems did interpreting Nietzsche pose in the Russian context? And how did this group of people deal with those problems?
Yeah, well, I think the main problems were, of course, Nietzsche's atheism, which didn't fit well with the cultural project that many of these thinkers were engaged in. The fact that he was German rather than Russian, so that's a little bit of a problematic thing. There's even some really imaginative attempts to claim Nietzsche as you know, maybe truly a Slavic thinker, which has some basis in some of Nietzsche's late writings. But there's one music critic in particular that explicitly and repeatedly refers to Nietzsche as a Polish writer, with the idea that Poles are also Slavs and therefore somehow, you know, closer in spirit to the Russians. Apart from that, you know, it's also, I think, just the fact that a lot of these critics and commentators that reference some of Nietzsche's ideas, they did not all have a clear grasp of what Nietzsche's ideas actually were. And so it does raise the question of how many of them were seriously engaging in Nietzsche's work. Some of them definitely were. In the case of Emil Mettner, who was a music critic and also involved in the literary symbolist movement, he was actually researching Nietzsche and hoping to write a biography of the philosopher. But in many cases, I think that these were ideas that were picked up as much from conversations and excerpts that had been published in Russian as from sitting down and reading Nietzsche's ideas directly. So there was also then a tendency to blur Nietzsche's ideas and Wagner's ideas, which again were not necessarily understood directly by looking at the artist himself, but from this general culture, some of the performances of Wagner's works, and the associations that these awoke. And it was difficult for me at first because I did a lot of reading of Nietzsche and I kept being frustrated that so many of these people were getting some of his ideas wrong. And, you know, then you step back and you say, well, actually, it's really interesting thinking about this, not so much in terms of do they properly understand Nietzsche, but what are they doing with his ideas? And what they wanted to do was respond to problems that they were identifying in contemporary Russian society, some of which Nietzsche had, of course, identified as problems of modernity, but others that were, of course, particular to the Russian sphere. And so, you know, you have some creative reinterpretation that comes in.
Yeah, you mentioned that there's this interesting attempt to integrate Nietzsche's ideas from The Birth of Tragedy, or however they understood them, with the writings of the Orthodox philosopher Solovyov. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yeah, so this is tied in with the idea that Nietzsche's one big mistake was that he sort of wrote religion out of the picture. And the other key figure that a lot of the members of cultured society at the time draw on are the ideas of Vladimir Solovyov. In particular, some of his ideas about creativity as transforming and spiritualizing humanity. So the idea that through the creative impulse, you actually remake yourself into something that is closer to God. So by bringing those two things together, the idea that, you know, music can be this unifying force. Solovyov also has his own interpretation of music as the most spiritual of forces. They're able to overcome that issue they have with Nietzsche, who doesn't seem to be talking about spiritualization, and bring it into a specifically Russian context. And Solovyov is really central in allowing them to do that.
Mm-hmm. You also mentioned that a big part of musical metaphysics is this attempt to reach out to the narod, which is this eternal concern for the Russian intelligentsia.
Yes.
So what sort of experiments were put into practice to make this a reality? And how did it go?
So I kept being bothered by the clear disconnect between these elites and the narod, who they, of course, like to idealize and talk about. And I found two examples of individuals or groups that were really actively trying to reach out to the narod, which made really fascinating case studies. And the first of these was the so-called People's Conservatory that was founded in Moscow after the 1905 revolution. The idea was that this would be a conservatory not for, you know, members of higher society, but actually for workers. So they planned, for instance, that the costs would be very low. Lessons would be, for the most part, in the evenings rather than during the day, because, of course, if you're a worker, you can't just not go to work. So they were trying to plan everything around this imagined worker schedule. But the rationale that they had for doing this was really interesting. And this was that the Narod had actually been in the process of forgetting what it meant to be truly Russian. And so the idea was that through teaching them music, intelligentsia would actually be helping the Narod to reclaim this Russianness that they had themselves lost. And they had very particular ways that they envisioned doing this as well. Like choral song was a huge concept here, because they have this idea that if music is supposed to create unity, which is, of course, part of this Nietzschean idea of music being the Dionysian unity, and they feel that unity is lacking in Russian society, they say, well, what better way to bring people together and unify them than by having them all get together and sing the same things in these massive choirs? And there's a whole theoretical basis of this. They have arguments about whether or not lessons should be given on individual instruments. And there's this constant pressure to minimize the amount of individual work you do with these students, because you want them to actually embrace this idea of the collective, which is part of what they believe, you know, true Russian identity should be related to. And one of my most interesting finds in the archive was actually a number of letters from students at one of these classes at the People's Conservatory. And the fascinating thing to see was just this complete disconnect between what the teachers were, you know, dedicating themselves to trying to do. And it should be noted, you know, most of these people were not getting much of a salary for this. It was really what they saw as their goodwill effort to reach out to the people. But in many of these letters, the students were actually complaining about the fact that they didn't necessarily want the mass song experience. That's not why they wanted to study music. And it keeps echoing this more individualist perspective that they want to study music because when they hear music, it moves them personally. And they want to be able to do that for themselves. And in some of the letters, there's almost a sense of resentment that their teachers haven't been giving them this individual ability. So it's this really fascinating conflict between what the intelligentsia are imagining they're doing for the people, and then this feedback that you're getting from the people that are actually supposedly being remade. So that was one of the examples I looked at. The other one I looked at was a little bit less going to the people, but it was also part of this idea of moving beyond individuality and creating a collective sense of belonging. And that was the House of Song in Moscow. And the founder of the House of Song, this woman, Dalgame, who had come back to Russia. She had married, I believe, a Frenchman and had been living in France for a while. But her goal was to create this artistic collective, really, in which you would have patrons who would subscribe to the concerts, which meant that, you know, they had the right to go to all the concerts. But they would do things like they would vote on what kind of repertoire should be in the performances. And they would have special collective events where They would bring people together who were part of this collective to try and have them work together to actually create something. And I think the one case I looked at was this interesting translation of, I believe it was a Hindu text, that they were looking, first of all, for volunteers, for people who would write music for it, but then also volunteers for people who would help to collectively stage this event. And it was not about doing this for audiences. The goal was, of course, for there to ultimately not be an audience per se that was separate from the performers, but that everyone would be involved in the experience.
Yeah, this tension that you describe between these collective aspirations of elite music lovers on the one hand and the actual desires of the broader audience that's listening to and playing music in this period, it certainly comes up in attitudes towards the three main composers that you describe as well. So to turn to that, let's start with Scriabin, who is the basis of chapter two in your book. So you write that in his early development, he seemed particularly ill-suited to fill the unifying role of a contemporary Russian Orpheus. So why was that? And how was Scriabin elevated by some into the role of Orpheus?
So the idea of Orpheus ties back to the point I made about the lack of specificity in this concept of musical metaphysics. And basically, there was general agreement about the idea that music was a spiritual transcendent force, that Russia needed some kind of figure, musical figure, that could help reunify the country after the trauma, particularly of the 1905 revolution. But where there wasn't agreement was who that figure should be and what his music should sound like. And so where you start having a lot of disagreements within this community of Nietzsche's orphans is when you get to the point of actually trying to say which contemporary composer might have the ability through his music to bring about this transformation. And Scriabin is fascinating in many ways because he is, of all the composers, he's the one who himself embraces a lot of these ideals about music and really sees himself as a figure who, you know, he literally believes that through his music, he's going to bring the world to an end. The reason initially he seems so problematic is this basic dichotomy between the individual and the collective. And particularly in Scriabin's early development, if you read his philosophical notebooks, he is an extreme individualist to the point of solipsism in some of his writings. He has some moments where he basically seems to doubt the existence of everything around him except himself, right? So, you know, everything else might be simply a figment of his imagination, or, you know, he actually has created the world around him, and so he somehow is the ultimate and only, in some cases, being. And he's very harshly critiqued by some of his contemporaries for this extreme individualism. What becomes interesting is how he is then sort of re-inscribed by his admirers, particularly by about 1910 or so, when he comes back to Russia after he's been living abroad for a few years, not as an individualist, but as someone who is desiring the sort of soborny or collective unity. And that is partly embodied in his own philosophical development and his recognition of himself then as he develops, not as the only existing consciousness in the world, but as basically part of this universal consciousness. It's much more complicated than that, but in short terms, he is recognizing sort of the unity of all consciousnesses into this absolute consciousness. And this actually fits in much better with the collective impulse and desire that many of the cultural elite had. And so they start interpreting his musical and philosophical development in these particular ways and emphasizing this increasingly collective aspect of his musical writing and sort of trying to minimize the extreme individualism of his youth.
And central to his compositions and to his personal sort of mythology as a prophet was this mystery that he was working on. What was it supposed to be like?
So the mystery is, it was Scriabin's life work. It was something that he continued to develop over the course of his creative career. And his conception of it changed over time. And so if you talk about what he had envisioned it to be, it can vary depending what point in his own development you talk about. In its sort of broadest terms, he described it as a musical experience, not just musical, but this sort of universal experience that would take place over the course of 7 days in a temple in India that he was going to have specially built for this event. And it would be not just music, but you would have colors, you would have basically the pillars of this temple were supposed to disintegrate into color at some point in time. You would have various smells and everything. And this experience would bring all the peoples of the world together for a moment of final mass ecstasy, after which the multiplicity of the existing world would come to an end. So it's really this vision of the end of the universe that he thought through his music and through this experience of the mystery, he was destined to bring about. In some ways, it's drawing on theosophy, which was a spiritual movement that Scriabin was interested in. In some ways, he is very clearly adapting the ideas of theosophy for his own ends. In theosophy, if I remember correctly, the argument was that we were at the fifth stage of humanity, and we had to go through, I believe, 7 stages of humanity. But Scriabin wasn't willing to accept that this was, not the final end of everything. And so he had this reinterpretation that he brought in that through his music, he would actually speed up time itself. And in the experience of the mystery, we would progress through these final phases of humanity and come to the ultimate end. And as an idea, it's very strange to try to place this side by side with the sort of more Christian Orthodox view of some of his admirers. And one of the really interesting things that comes out of looking at this is not just Scriabin's own idea of what he wanted to do, but how it was reinterpreted by his admirers, who would often give it more of a Christian twist. And they were particularly able to do this because, of course, Scriabin died in 1915 without having finished writing the mystery. So they could then, of course, reflect upon it and offer their own interpretations, which were actually very different from what Scriabin had intended.
Mm. Yeah, it's certainly setting the bar very high for a single work of music. although
yes.
you point out that even though he never completed the mystery, it was partially realized in his Prometheus. But I was wondering what your approach was to writing about Scriabin's music in particular, since especially for him and his followers, the experience of group emotion together with color, smell, sound, all of these things was supposed to offer a really mass transformative experience. How do you go about writing about music, that was supposed to incorporate so many elements and B, was never actually realized?
Mm-hmm. So When I looked at Scriabin's music in particular, I drew very strongly. There's a lot of wonderful musicology that has looked at the development of Scriabin's harmonic and melodic language to try and understand how he is creating a new, innovative compositional language. The issue I had with a lot of that as someone who was writing for a historical audience is a lot of this scholarship is very specialized and not really accessible to broader audiences who are not trained in music. And so the other thing I tried to do was look at not just how musicologists have analyzed the development of his musical style, but also how his contemporaries talked about it. And some of this was also, of course, very specialized and focused, particularly the writings of Leonid Sabineyev. But a lot of it was more focused on questions of emotional response in the listener. And I found this was a useful way of, you know, getting at not just the specificities of what Scriabin was doing with the notes, which may or may not tell people much who are not trained in music, but thinking about how people at the time, at least the people writing these reviews and such, had responded to the music and what sort of emotional content they were identifying in it. And I found that to be, for my purposes, a much more effective way of thinking about the impact that music could have on audiences. The problem, of course, was that people were in quite strong disagreement about what the emotions actually were that this kind of music was evoking, which I think talks to the multivalence of music itself and the experience of music. That you know, however much you can say about the actual score or the sounds that you are hearing, so much of one's response is based on this immediate personal reaction, which is really a challenge to get at.
Absolutely. So to turn to a quite different composer, let's shift to the Metner brothers. So how did Nikolai Metner's approach differ from Scriabin's? How is his music different? And what was his claim to the status of Russian Orpheus?
So Scriabin is often considered to be one of, if not the, but definitely one of the most innovative modernist composers of his generation. And he really developed his own unique harmonic language. Metner was much more in the realm of someone who was continuing classical, so romantic, tonal musical language. He was not someone who wanted to throw out the experience of past composers. He was a great admirer of Beethoven, for instance. And so, while he does innovative things in terms of rhythm and harmony, he is always staying within what he considered to actually be absolute laws that music had to function within. He believed that there were these inherent existing laws that dictated what made good music and what made bad music, and that to transgress these was, of course, a great danger. And this was one of the problems of modernity, that some of these absolute laws had been transgressed. So that was his conception of music and his role as a composer. So it's really this almost Platonic idea that you have the ideal form of music that you are then striving to reach in your own composition. He's also, unlike Scriabin, someone who was not personally comfortable with this idea of the Russian Orpheus who would transform society through his music. He's always much more cautious and doesn't himself engage in the same sort of philosophical dreamings that Scriabin did. But He has an older brother who I had mentioned briefly earlier, Emil Mettner, who was much more the symbolist sort of mastermind behind interpreting his younger brother's music. And this discourse that Nikolai was an alternate Orphic figure, whereas with Scriabin, you can get some of it from Scriabin himself. With the Mettner brothers, that discourse is coming from the elder brother, Emil, rather than from the composer himself. So you have this interesting family dynamic then that is coming in. And Emil Mettner, as someone who was very involved in the literary symbolist movement, had a great deal of influence over some of the other writings of the time. And so he influenced writers like Andrei Bielli to write reviews of Nikolai Mettner's music within this framework of philosophical transcendence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they also have this sort of ménage à trois going, which I guess was sort of typical for the period, would you say?
Yeah, surprisingly so, actually. And it's funny because a lot of the really wonderful scholarship from the Soviet period about Nikolai Mettner and a number of his letters that were published in the Soviet period completely avoid discussing this at all, because it was not, of course, the sort of thing that you wanted to discuss about your great composers at that point in time. But both Emil and Nikolai had the same wife at different moments in time. She was also a musician, and she was very much a supporter, like Emil Mettner, of Nikolai's great musical talent. And yeah, it got to the point that for various reasons, Nikolai's parents didn't approve of the relationship. And so they tried to break up Nikolai and Anna. There are various things that happen. And then Emil actually marries Anna. And then things continue to develop with Nikolai. And at some point in time, she's basically living with Nikolai instead of with Emil, although their relationship is not made official until, I believe, after the start of the war. And it's a very complicated relationship. It was wonderful for me as a researcher, because the relationship between the three of them is cataloged in great detail through these personal letters, particularly between Emil and Anna. Nikolai didn't write nearly so often, but Emil and Anna wrote to each other virtually every day. And so you have all sorts of difficult personal situations, but also this incredible record of the creative development of all three.
Yeah, that's a wonderful resource for a historian. So to turn finally now to Rachmaninoff, who's the subject of chapter 4 in the book, he is, I would say, easily the most widely beloved of the composers you feature. But for Nietzsche's Orphans, he was actually a very problematic figure, and part of the problem was, in fact, his popularity. So why was that?
I think this really speaks to the fear in amongst Nietzsche's orphans of the common people, actually. And so there's this sense, of course, they want to create this better idealized Russia, more spiritual Russia. But there's this sense that things are not necessarily going that well amongst the people themselves, for a number of reasons. So modernity has sort of led them astray. They don't have the right value systems anymore. And a lot of that, I think, comes to the foreground in discussions about Rachmaninoff, because the concern is that people, yes, they seem to love Rachmaninoff more than the other composers, but do they love him for the right reasons, or are they just sort of wallowing in this individualistic, emotional pessimism that is so, they claim it's so common to the era? And so the concern is that Rachmaninoff in writing music that is perceived as overly pessimistic or melancholy is actually not using music to transform and spiritualize society. He's just sort of wallowing in the problems that modernity has wrought, and that this is what makes him popular. And so it's this very dismissive view from at least a portion of Nietzsche's orphans about the wider public. And I think some of this is also tied in with concerns about capitalism, and there's always this great skepticism of bourgeois culture and sort of street culture. And Rachmaninoff is somehow associated with that because of his popularity. And even his supporters, particularly the poet Marietta Shagignan, who I talk about extensively, who really embraces Rachmaninoff as the true vision of this Orpheus in the modern age, even she is concerned at moments that his music is too pessimistic for the needs of Russian society. And in her case, she'll actually, in letters to the composer, complain about this to him. So there is this strong sense that Nietzsche's orphans themselves are expecting something from music, and that they have this right to push back if the composers aren't meeting those desired goals.
Yeah, you have this funny anecdote in the book. I guess Rachmaninoff himself preferred to avoid the kind of metaphysical discussions that Emil Mettner, for example, really reveled in. And there's this scene where he's having a conversation with the Mettner brothers, and they're trying to talk to him about philosophy and music, and he wants to talk about the proper method of cooking
yes.
Italian pasta.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a great anecdote that I think really captures the different personalities of the artists.
Mm-hmm. You pointed out his association with melancholy and perhaps pessimism. How would you say this is manifested in his music?
Well, again, when I look at the music, what I really was relying on extensively are responses that I found at the time period. And so these are terms that appear repeatedly in reviews of his work. I think in terms of like trying to place it in his music, it has a lot to do with these long melodies that you find, these long sort of late romantic, very singable melodies. And just the sort of harmonies that he makes use of. So a lot of minor type sounds. But what I was really interested in was not so much identifying in the music itself as in identifying what people were taking from it. Another example of this would be, of course, the use of the start of the Dies Irae chant from the Requiem Mass, which was identified as appearing, and clearly it appears in some of his works, such as The Isle of the Dead, and some commentators actually notice it in other works as well, which of course has very clear associations, as does his programmatic work, The Bells, which has a text by Edgar Allan Poe that has very clear symbolic associations with it.
Mm-hmm. So to bring us forward in time up to World War I, a major scene in your book is the funeral of Scriabin, who dies unexpectedly in 1915. And this is the cause of great mourning and anxiety among his fans and followers. So what happens not only with Scriabin, but more broadly to the dream of musical metaphysics with the outbreak of World War I and then the revolutions in 1917?
So I think there are a number of directions that these ideas of musical metaphysics go. They're placed under great strain with the outbreak of war in 1914. Part of that is tied in with the increasing nationalist fervor that comes out of the war, and you know the attacks on people, especially Germans and Jews, who are not ethnically Russian. So they're potentially suspect groups. And this spills over into the musical realm. Not entirely. I mean, it's not like there is an official ban that says no German music can be played during the war, but unofficially, there's this strong sense, and there are discussions about is it appropriate for Russians to listen to German music, or, you know, are there inherent tendencies of the militaristic German spirit in the music of the time? And a lot of people come to believe that that's the case. And from there, it's a really easy slippage to go from that to saying that, well, if that's the case, the appropriate kind of music for us to listen to is actually music by someone who is ethnically Russian. And this, of course, because of his German ancestry, places Nikolai Metner in a very difficult position. In the case of Scriabin, his death in 1915 is really a major blow, in part because so many of these dreams of, you know, the future more spiritual Russia were tied in with images of what Scriabin's mystery was supposed to do. And so particularly in the months after his death and the year or two after his death, what you find is discussions of Scriabin's death focus on a couple of things. They focus on trying to explain what happened. And they're never willing to accept the idea that this was just, you know, bad luck, that he died of a blood infection from a boil that he had. But there's this constant idea that there has to be a higher spiritual meaning, and we have to interpret what that is. And initially, so not that long after his death, when things in the war are not as bad as they're going to become later, there's this idea that Scriabin has shown us the way forward. We need to continue to do this. We need to continue developing our Russianness or spirituality. And this will lead to our victory, not just militarily, but spiritually as well. As time goes on and people become more skeptical of military victory in the direction that Russia as a country is heading, a lot of this also spills over into interpretations of Scriabin and what he and his music actually meant for the country. And so there's this new narrative of Satanism that is actually tied in specifically with Scriabin, saying that he wasn't, you know, this great spiritual figure. He was actually awakening dark forces. But the really important aspect of this is that it's not just a way for them to talk about Scriabin, but it's a way for them to try and make sense of the direction that Russia itself is going in at this point in time, which I think really speaks to the way that music is a metonym for talking about the problems of Russian society more broadly at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. And Rachmaninoff, of course, leaves not too long after the revolution in 1917. Why does he decide to leave, and how does that impact his legacy?
So he doesn't write extensively about why he decides to leave at the time, but he clearly was concerned about the direction that things were going after the revolution in February. He applied to get a visa to leave even earlier, and he, I believe, is able to leave in December 1917, so after the Bolshevik revolution in October. And he claims at least that he's only leaving for a concert tour, but obviously he chooses then never to come back to Russia. My impression is a lot of this has to do with the uncertainty of just living in a country that has been at war and is now going through revolution. He's concerned about his family, and he has actually a relatively straightforward path out. I mean, obviously it's not that easy to leave, but as a recognized artist, he is able to leave on a performance visa, take his family with him, and he's able to establish himself because of the broader popularity of his music And he basically remakes himself, less as a composer after 1917 and more as a performer, and actually does very well financially.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly was very nostalgic for the Russia that he left behind, but there are a couple of cases in his reminiscences about his estate in particular of Ivanovka. There's a scene where he talks about the last time that he went there, and he is talking about, you know, working on the estate and so on and so forth. And then he has this moment when the peasants come to confront him, and basically they tell him that he should leave. He says that, you know, he's always treated them well and so on and so forth. And he say, yes, but you should leave anyway. And this was clearly a very traumatic thing for him, because he chooses not to discuss that any further, but there is this sense that, for his, himself and his family, he felt like this was not, a space where he was going to, be welcome anymore, mm-hmm. for whatever reason.
So overall, to do kind of a postmortem diagnosis, would you say that the story of musical metaphysics in Russia in the end is a sort of tragedy, where all of these dreams of transformation through music and high culture come to an end in World War I in 1917? Or would you say that some of the aspirations live on, albeit in altered form, in the Soviet state and perhaps abroad?
I think there's a tragic aspect to it, but there are also reverberations of it that carry on both in the emigre community and in the Soviet Union. The experiments in the 1920s with things like mass song and so on, there's still this great emphasis on the unifying power of music. And actually, some of the people who were involved in things like the People's Conservatory before 1917 continue their work with a very slight like reworking of their own philosophy in the Soviet period. So someone like Nadezhda Bryusova becomes very influential in Soviet musical education. Obviously, the discussion of spirituality is going to shift after 1917, but there still is this idea that music has this incredible force. And if you look at how the Soviet state used music as a cultured influence and giving tickets to concerts to workers and these sorts of things, there is this continued aspiration that music can somehow better the human spirit. You have some continuity as well in the emigre community. In that context, I would say it tends to be more often tied to this realm of idealized memory and sort of the celebration of the Russia that was lost after 1917, at least in the sources that I have looked at. And then, of course, there is the tragic aspect of it, that so many of these aspirations and hopes simply were not met. And you could ask yourself, I mean, maybe that was inevitable. The sort of expectations that were placed on music were so high. Maybe it was simply always going to be the case that at some point in time they were going to be disappointed. But the continued importance of music, I think, in Soviet society does speak to at least an echo of some of these ideals of the late imperial period.
Mm-hmm. Before we leave the book entirely, I wanted to ask you if among these composers, do you have a favorite or a least favorite, perhaps? And if so, which compositions catch your fancy in particular?
You know, I like each composer for different reasons. Musically, I was drawn to the project initially because of Scriabin, mm-hmm. And particularly Scriabin's piano works, his piano sonatas, the Fifth Sonata, the Ninth Sonata, some of his late poems like Towards the Flame, which I just found incredibly evocative and unique. And so from a purely musical perspective, that is where my heart, I think, still lies. Rachmaninoff's music, of course, is wonderful and I think very accessible to people in a way that Scriabin's music is definitely not. In the case of Nikolai Metner, I think that he was the composer I actually didn't know about until I started the project and discovered him from the comparisons that were always being drawn with Scriabin and Rachmaninoff. But he has some incredible works, and the ones that I would in particular reference would be his Forgotten Melodies, which I do mention briefly in the book, and also his two Sonata Vocalise and Suite Vocalise for piano and voice. I only know of one recording of them, but they are really beautiful works and deserve to be better known.
Yeah, thank you for the recommendations. I have to admit I hadn't heard of Nikolai Metner, and I will listen after our interview. So we're about out of time, but before we leave you, could you tell us what you're working on now?
Yeah, so I have a couple of projects that I am exploring at present. One of them sort of continues into the emigre communities and is trying to look at the ways in which Russian identity was preserved or questioned in amongst the emigre community after the 1917 revolution, when you have these various diaspora groups. And then the other project that I've been playing with actually was inspired by my constant frustration when I was working on the first project, in that I felt that I learned a lot about the cultural elite. I learned a lot about reception within certain spheres of society. But I felt like I was never really getting at the experiences of vast portions of society in the mm-hmm. Russian Empire. And so, you know, I asked myself, well, where would you go to get that sort of experience? And the other aspect that I kept coming across in my reading, but I didn't go into for the first project, was actually the realm of religious music. And so the other interesting thing that's happening at this time is there's a whole series of discussions about the role of music in religious life. And so my new project is looking at the ways in which the experience of sound and orality in religious worship, so Orthodox churches, synagogues, so on and so forth, actually helped or opposed in some cases the creation of an imperial Russian identity. So I'm looking at Orthodox church music reform and focusing on particular centers where you have a range of ethnic and religious groups. So I've done a lot of work in Kazan, looking at sort of multi-ethnicity, multi-confessionality, and the role of music in those contexts.
That sounds really fascinating, and in some ways a natural outgrowth of some of your interest in the national question in Nietzsche's Children. So thank you so much for being with us today, Rebecca Mitchell. I really enjoyed speaking with you, and please take care.
Thank you.